You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation strengthens education in northern New Mexico so that learners of all ages can reach their full potential. Offering grants that fund public education and community projects, building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood programs, providing K-12 wraparound services for students and teachers with Inquiry Science as the flagship initiative, investing in students' dreams through scholarships, and creating a solid foundation for learning and systemic change through partnership and advocacy. For program information or to give, visit lanlfoundation.org. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Anna Sofair. She's an author, she's an archaeoastronomer, she's founder of the Solstice Project, and joining us also are Rob Weiner. He's an archaeologist, he's getting his PhD in archaeology at the University of Colorado Boulder, and Rich Friedman, who's a geologist and GIS specialist, Geographic Information Systems. And the three of them are giving a presentation called Chacoan Astronomy, Cosmography, Roads, and Ritual Power, Insights into the Chaco World Using New Technologies. It's on Thursday, the 24th of January at 6:30 in the evening at the James A. Little Theater at the School for the Deaf here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And it's sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to have you. Anna, you were on the show on the Radio Cafe many years ago talking about what you've been doing with your life. This really became your life work. You've been going to Chaco Canyon for decades. Many years ago, you discovered an astronomical calendar, if that's the right word, while photographing rock art. Tell us that story.
Well, I joined a group of amateur archaeologists who were volunteers there recording rock art throughout the canyon, which has wonderful amount of rock art everywhere. And the second day I was on the desert in my life, I was told to maybe do Fajada Butte, which is this 500-foot towering mass. People know it who go right. It's the first thing you see when you come into Chaco. And I was with a very good climber, a fellow who had all the right equipment. And the second day, well, the first day we did several sites and went up to the top and got to a very large spiral, much bigger than anything we had seen, 15 inches across. But it was late in the day, it was late in the afternoon, and we said we should come back the next day. Well, we happened to get there near noon, and we were a week from solstice, and there's this beautiful dagger of light right through the center of the spiral. And I had studied enough of archaeoastronomy in visiting sites in Mesoamerica, Maya sites particularly, and that sort of gave me the clues that maybe this was more than happenstance. I was an artist at that time. I had a sense of design maybe that was stronger than a sense of research at that moment, and that gave me a powerful image that I just couldn't forget. And then I began to work with science collaborators, wonderful people, a physicist at NSF who had a strong astronomy background, an architect trained in Germany in shadow and light formation, and that started the whole path of doing research in Chaco.
Now, this was a spiral, as you say, one of those rock art spirals, and a line of light, you call a dagger of light, was going right through the exact center of the spiral,
yes.
And it was the solstice.
Yes. And then the big question was, would it do that at any time of the year? For instance, if it was just facing south, would it be a noon marking every day? But we had the feeling that this was special to that time. And then it took visits particularly timed, like 5 weeks before the solstice. Well, it turned out it was about 5 inches off of the center. And that led to, well, what's happening at equinox? And there was a needle of light through a little spiral up to the left, right through the center on the day of equinox. Then we looked at winter solstice, and two daggers of light come down on each side of the spiral. And it's because these three slabs are framing the light. They are causing these patterns. And people work there very carefully, it appears, deliberately to shift them in that particular position to do that, and maybe work them as well.
So from the outside, these slabs don't look like anything special. They look like sort of vertical rock formations that aren't anything beautiful or designed, but they do this. There was some skepticism at first on the part of archaeologists, and you weren't a quote-unquote real archaeologist, and I'm guessing there might have even been a little sexism in there too, who knows, but anyway, the...
I know.
Well, yeah, and there was some doubt whether this was real.
Yes, and I wasn't in the field. I wasn't from New Mexico. I wasn't trained in this particular thing. But the advantages I had were maybe being independent, and also because I didn't know a lot in any special field, I needed to collaborate, and that's been the principle by which the Solstice Project and I have worked for now 4 decades. Bring in the people who can really look at the data and gather it, carefully document, and not a bunch of theory, not a bunch of preconceptions, but what is there? And that's where my two partners in the beginning were so wonderful. And then we had a big finding when we saw that the moon was casting shadows as it rose. Instead of from its movement above near noon or midday, what was happening was the moon rises at two extremes in an 18 to 19 year cycle, very far north and then not so far north. And that movement across the horizon of about 13 degrees causes two shadows. One goes right through the center of the spiral, just where the dagger of light goes, and the other goes on the left edge of the spiral where the winter light forms. So that was controversial. But on the other hand, when people began to understand that cycle, they began to see that the deliberate care that was taken at the site. Not so much a view of it as so casual, oh, the rocks just fell. There had to be some planning, some thought behind all of that coming together on that one spiral.
So it's an incredibly sophisticated astronomical calendar. Do we know how it was used?
Well, probably ceremonially. And again, I got clues from such wonderful people who would consult with me. Alfonso Ortiz absolutely thought it was a Puebloan shrine, not an observatory, as some people wanted to call it, or not even a calendar, but a place where, as he said, officiants would go, a few people, because it's very intimate. You just, a few people can see this. And those light formations would tell them when the ceremonies should start below. And he said it was very powerful symbolism of the sun and the moon and the joining of these two, which is very important in Pueblo culture.
So tell us the story of how these ideas came to really be accepted. I mean, you started this Solstice Project, but have you been able to attract archaeologists and native researchers and so on to build on these discoveries?
Very much. The next set of information that came in for us was doing a survey with the National Geodetic Survey through Philip Tualetztiwa, who's from Hopi and happened to be deputy director of the National Geodetic Survey of NOAA. And he could bring in the very highest skilled surveyors at that time. And they did all of the 14 largest buildings of Chaco. And that's when we had another set of data that so integrated with what we had already found, because these same extreme positions for the moon, the solstices, the equinoxes, all together were in the alignments of the buildings and even in the patterning they formed from building to building. And then from there, we began with archaeologists to look at the roads. Mike Marshall became a very wonderful colleague in that work. He's an archaeologist from Corrales who had done the work on the outlying Chaco communities. And we went out on the roads. And it was through his work that we followed the astronomy of the North Road, the fact that it went directly north, but it went down Coots Canyon after 35 miles of coming out of Chaco, this incredibly steep Badlands Canyon. And he's doing the research in the field there, he climbs up and he finds a stairway and broken pots. This was a huge shift in understanding for us, and I think for other people, that the roads had a ceremonial and symbolic aspect. And all along, the Solstice Project, our policy has always been to share what we learned, not to ask questions, it's very sensitive material, but not to hold it to ourselves, but to go and show slides at Hopi, at Acoma, etc. And people wouldn't say very much, but in some ways, the less they said, the more you knew what you found had great value. And I was encouraged by that, by the few things they did say. And then they participated in interviews for our film, The Mystery of Chaco Canyon, as they had for the Sundagger film, to talk about what I didn't want to talk about, which was the symbolic power of these sites and these roads. But in their words, they've just come to life on another level. So I've been very lucky that that correspondence has happened.
The roads between these different sites, I mean, in Chaco Canyon, there's this place where the, for lack of a better word, what do you call it, astronomical calendar?
The Sundagger?
The Sundagger.
I just call it the Sundagger site. Okay. Solar. I have used a calendrical site. They're not the right words, but...
Right.
Hierophany.
Yeah, it's a hierophany. That's the fancy word for a site that has a revelation with shadow and light of something more than just a calendar.
Hierophany. Ladies and gentlemen, we've learned a new word today.
It's a great
the
word.
The eruption of the divine into the earthly sphere is how I've heard it defined.
Very interesting. So between this site and other sites, there are these very straight lines that are roads that had been thought of as trade routes, but now they're being reinterpreted. Is that correct?
That finding that the North Road, 35 miles long, sometimes 5 miles of parallel routes, 30 feet wide, incredibly straight, beautifully engineered, and then no sites to speak of that are residential along it. It's not for trade and transportation. It's an expression, as the Pueblo people have said, of the relationship of the ceremonial center of downtown, what we call downtown Chaco, but those great ceremonial buildings to the north and to below, to the world below, is what Paul Pino would say. Place of emergence and return of the spirits of the dead, in his words, in Ed Ladd of Zuni's words. But from there, other people have done, well, they were doing then, and now they've done a tremendous amount more work, especially Rich on roads, and Rob's taking that on. So roads have become this great map of mystery, and I leave it to them.
Well, I mean, when I think about, I was looking at the map with the site and then these very straight lines coming out of it, and, you know, it's interesting to me that they wanted to have, that they built these straight lines, which is, first of all, not easy to do, and we can talk about how that was done. But the words linear thinking are often used in a disparaging way these days. You know, you're not supposed to be a linear thinker. What was the meaning, the purpose of having such straight lines?
That's a great question. And I guess here I do turn to the words and the thoughts of Pueblo people. Alfonso Ortiz of Okeawinge Pueblo was also an anthropologist, and he's talked to me quite a lot. And very early, he knew what we found with the North Road was incredibly significant. But he said the translation in Tewa for road is channel for the life's breath. That just about says as much as anything. But you'll see it in the literature, that there's the road of life, the road of the sun, the road of the moon, the road for daylight. It's powerful for the Zuni people, and then roads that are used for pilgrimage to sacred sites. And the straightness of a road seems to be part of that. That's the idea, that the straighter it is, the more powerful it is. But you're right about that's the distinguishing factor to know a Chaco road. If you were looking out on a map of what was happening in the Chaco land, you'd see that a Navajo route, even one maybe 300 years ago, would weave around the mesas. But what happens with Chaco roads is they go straight over. And then they continue in straight trajectories. And that's quite stunning. And that's how we find them.
What do we know about how they built them? I mean, when you think about designing a road, or when you think about any kind of design and architecture and so on, they all involve, as far as I'm concerned, pencil and paper at the very least. What kind of tools were they using? Do we have any idea?
Stick, stones, and string. That's what was available. To do a straight line, you can do it pretty easily with three sticks. You just use them to line up each other and continue on. Anybody who's built fence knows how to do that. For the rest of it, though, I mean, you're talking about any construction type you see on a modern road, you see on these. You see leveling, which is where you excavate one side to level out the other side to make a flat surface. You'll see excavation, which is typically the most common, where it's been excavated down, sometimes up to a meter or so down. Those are the really deep ones. And then sometimes it's just a matter of clearing the brush off, clearing stones off so that you've got a nice clean pathway. Lots of different forms of construction, but they all involve people out there moving dirt and sticks, brush and stones, with stone and stick tools and baskets. So it's, when you think of a 30-foot wide road going 40 miles, that's a lot of material to move.
And a lot of labor and a lot of people.
Yeah, and you don't see campsites along the roads, things like that. It would indicate they're used for trade if you see campsites. And it also means that whoever was working on these, if they stayed out there, they aren't leaving a trace of being there behind.
What is the state of these roads now?
They're disappearing quickly. As you might imagine, in 1,000 years, 800 to 1,000 years, you've got erosion, you've got deposition of sediments from wind and water. So over time, they gradually disappear. And many of them have already disappeared, I think. And some in the last 20 to 30 years, their visibility is remarkably lessened. It's just due to you put more sand or more dirt on top of it. It changes that visual cue that you see to know a road's there, and you lose it.
But they're still there enough that you know that they're there.
They're still there. You might.
I mean,
not
you can
be
still
to
see them. Like, how do you?
Some you can't. No.
Rich can see them.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Yeah, they get really subtle. The one example we'll show in the presentation. There's a road. You know, it's 10 meters or 30 feet wide. It's 3.5 inches deep in the center. That's all that's left. So 3.5 inches over 30 feet. Visually, you cannot see it. It's impossible to see it. But you can see it with LIDAR, which is one of the technologies we've been using, and also aerophotography.
Yeah, tell us more about that.
LIDAR, that's, when you get into technology, everything's an acronym. So LIDAR is light ranging and detection. So that's basically using a really fancy laser rangefinder. In this case, it's mounted in a plane, and you fly over the ground, and it's collecting anywhere from 1,000 to 5,000 pulses a second. It sends a point of light down to the ground, and then it measures how long it took for that reflection to get back to the airplane, so it knows how far down it is. Then you've got really fancy GPS units on there that can be resolved to within a centimeter or so of their location, so that you know exactly where that point was in space.
So if a signal comes back some tiny fraction of a second later, that means it's the 3.5 inches deeper?
Yeah, yeah. And it's being used a lot in the jungles in Mesoamerica to find sites, because you get enough points of light down there, you can actually see down to the actual surface instead of just the vegetation.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take a quick break. Please stay with us. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation invests in the dreams and futures of Northern New Mexico students through scholarships. Support is available for 4-year and 2-year degrees, as well as trade certifications. January 22, 2019 is the deadline to apply for 4-year scholarships available to high school seniors and current undergraduates who are residents of the 7 counties of Northern New Mexico and meet additional criteria. Citizenship is not required. For more information and application details, visit lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. And now back to our program. This area, Chaco Canyon, the location of the Sun Dagger, the location of these roads that we're talking about, is a dry, austere, kind of bleak landscape of rocks and buttes and mesas and very little water. Why was this chosen as a place for a massive building project, essentially? I mean, not only is there this Sun Dagger calendar, or whatever that great word was that you used.
Horophony.
Horophony.
Sun Dagger Horophony.
But there were also, I mean, there's huge buildings that are still, I mean, they're ruins, but they're still visible. Why that site?
Well, if you're looking for a place to farm easily and have a successful large community, Chaco Canyon's probably the last place you would choose. It consistently receives less rainfall than surrounding areas in the San Juan Basin. Temperatures are consistently a couple degrees warmer or colder than the surrounding areas. There's very, very little wood available for burning fires or heating rooms. And every, with the exception of maybe one or two pieces of archaeological corn that have been found in the canyon, were all imported from a region to the west called the Chusca Mountains, which receives plenty of rainfall and even today is full of quite wonderful corn fields. So you don't go to Chaco Canyon to establish a large, vibrant population. You're going there for another reason. And I think the evidence that Anna's work has brought out and Rich and many other scholars is showing that what drew people there was the sort of magic of that landscape. These very features, Fajada Butte, and perhaps even the harshness of the place was itself the point that draws you in to do a different sort of activity than your everyday living, but activities that in our current times we would phrase as ritual or ceremonial. That very harshness, in other words, may have been the point.
So the ritual and ceremony that happened there, first of all, who are the descendants, do we know, of the people who used that site?
The descendants of the Chacoans are today's Pueblo people and some of today's Navajo people. So usually, you know, in past times, they would have been referred to as the Anasazi. More common terms today are ancestral Pueblo or ancient Pueblo, or just usually what we use is ancient Chacoans.
So given that their descendants are still with us, do they offer any clues, or are there other clues to how those rituals were, how that space was used?
To some extent, the fact that there's so many kivas, we can relate that to the Pueblo world today for sure. And they certainly value Chaco. I wouldn't have had so much resonance in my meetings and sharings with the Pueblos if that weren't true. But there's also a concept in the Pueblos that goes back, I think, to Chaco, saying that this was a place where people had a great deal of spiritual power, but power over other people, in the words of Paul Pino of Laguna. And that this became a kind of corruption of power. And even that the extraordinary knowledge and brilliance of the people was abusive, that it was controlling nature. And some people think, and it does come out from Pueblo people, Patuch Gilbert of Acoma and his brother Simon, saying that this was for them a time of great change, that they rejected Chaco for the extent of this centralized power and wealth, materialism, and that they went back to a more reciprocal relationship with nature. And it was a time of great disruption, but when once coming together in the Pueblos of today, of historic time, they were to live in a more egalitarian way. Nobody was to be so powerful and centralized in their power. So it's an extraordinary story, and it's one that we want to bring out in our new film, because I think it's also a lesson for us today, in a way.
Well, I was going to say, corruption, power over others, materialism, centralization of power and wealth, these are familiar themes that are not unique to our own era.
Yes, exactly. Alfonso Ortiz again said to me once, consider that there could be a conscious decision to devolve, a choice to devolve. And that sounded at first, what is he talking about? But that's such an interesting idea. Some people have the notion we should simplify our lives. We should be less materially consuming of the world, and we might survive longer as a civilization. So that wisdom might be something that we can draw on.
And so that was perhaps something that they were thinking about.
Yes.
And this area in Chaco Canyon was a location for, what would you call it, regrounding spiritually?
Well, they certainly see the brilliance. There's no other word for what people were doing there. I mean, you raise the question, how are they doing this without pencil and paper even? We think now, it's the word that comes to mind, it's kind of jargony in our own way, but the mindscape of the people there. How are they relating across a region that's twice the size of Ireland? And when we go out and look at these outlying sites, like Rich knows every one of them practically, they could be taken as models, 3D models, and you could take them back to Chaco and you'd see that's just what's in Chaco, or just 300 miles from each other. All that coordination, the roads standard 30 feet width often, the straightness, the going to special sites in the landscape. This is what we want to bring out, how amazingly coordinated it was. Without armies, without the beast of burden, we think without writing and math. What was the communication? What was the bonding?
Well, and how did they transport? I mean, as you said, they didn't have wood and food and all that stuff. Well, if you're going to go do ceremony, you need to eat and stay warm, and you need to have building materials and so on. How did they get them there?
By foot. It's astounding. I still can't quite get my head around 240,000 timbers from the Chuscas.
About 50 miles away.
And a good deal of the food, though that's a little bit in dispute.
Without the wheel.
Without the wheel, so human bodies. Why did they do it, Rich? I always ask Rich.
That's the ultimate question. Chaco was a special place. There was a reason for people to go there, and as Anna alluded to, a lot of the current Native Americans who live in this area, they have stories about Chaco. Once you start dealing with oral traditions, then quite often you deal with things that are never to be spoken of under improper circumstances, or you only speak of them under proper circumstances.
Is this a proper circumstance?
No. But Chaco is often, I've heard it referred to many times as being a place of great power, and a place where maybe that power wasn't used to the betterment of people as everyone wanted or thought it should be, and that's kind of why it went away.
So it went away, well, the people went away from it. I mean, it fell to ruin.
Yeah, it was a conscious decision to
close
Chaco, yes.
That people don't like the word abandon, the Pueblo people, because it's not a hysterical get out of Dodge right now. Careful closure, sealing of the buildings, burning of the kivas, where you had to take these massive roofs off to burn them. That was a ritual of its own, it appears.
So it was like, you know, we've screwed up, we've become corrupted, so let's just close up shop and start all over.
Sarah. But aren't they also holding a memory? That's what I mean, in some ways it's a conscious forgetting, but it's also a conscious remembering of what that was. And so people still go back. They go back now. They have shrines, pilgrimage. We haven't touched on a very big impact, we feel, Rob especially has brought this out, of Mesoamerican impact.
Tell us about that.
So yeah, jumping back to your earlier question about, you know, what types of ritual practices and what windows do we have on what was going on there. One of the ways we've thought about that is through the goods imported from Mesoamerica. And particularly striking, bizarre, sort of wondrous goods, things like scarlet macaws, hand carried up from, you know, the jungles of Mexico. This is a bird that, as a person living in the Four Corners region in the ancient times, you never would have seen a bird that's six different colors and can talk to you, mimic human speech. People were also bringing up bells made of copper. Of course, you don't have shiny metal things that make wondrous new sounds, but they're coming from this distant, sort of mythicized land. Chocolate beverages, cacao that was brought up and probably frothed or served in these beautiful geometric cylindrical vessels. The clearest parallels to these cylinder vessels the Chacoans were using are seen down in the Mesoamerican world, in the Maya country or in Monte Albán. So we see definitely an influx of objects, and I am quite sure along with these objects come ideas, you know, concepts of a religious nature. And of course, astronomy as well. We know that among Mesoamerican societies, the Maya in particular, astronomy was so incredibly and richly developed. Every one of those ceremonial complexes down there, everything is aligned. They have such a precise and incredible calendar, cycles of eclipses and all of these things. And to think that we have what's known as the classic period collapse, when these big monumental centers are depopulated in the Maya region and throughout other city-states of Mesoamerica, around 700, 800. And when do we see the rise of Chaco? Around 800. So, you know, we're not saying, oh, the Maya kings marched up to Chaco, but the idea for me, and I think my colleagues here as well, that those two processes are unrelated seems like a bit of a stretch.
Now, these objects that you were talking about from Mesoamerica were found by archaeologists, basically, in Chaco?
Yes, so in Pueblo Bonito in particular, which is the largest grade house in Chaco and actually the largest building in North America until the 1800s, when I think apartments built in Chicago outgrew it, the oldest part of that building, there were caches of these objects. So rooms with tens of thousands of pieces of turquoise, a room where the skeletons of numerous macaws were found, copper bells scattered throughout the different sites. These cacao vases were also cached in a single room. And one of the ways I've written about this is part of what these objects provided was stimulating and wonderful new sensory experiences. So new tastes, new sounds, new textures that sort of brought alive something indicative of a distant, wondrous place, whether that be a physical place or more metaphorical for people who came in temporarily to this very special center at Chaco.
I think it's an act of imagination for us to try to put oneself in the place of people who are living without all the kinds of stimulation that we have now, without, you know, access with the devices in our pockets to basically the entire world at any given moment. The fact of having a new object, or as you say, a new taste or a new smell from another place is a really big deal.
It's a really big deal. And I think in particular, we look at the way that many societies throughout history have conceived of places that are very far away, and it is across the board in cosmological terms, such that physical distance is equated to supernatural distance. So the fact that these things are coming from a place so far away may have been that they were also coming from a place of greater religious power or spiritual power, however you want to say it.
Or at least that was attributed.
That was attributed, right.
Or it could also be that the Mesoamerican people came to Chaco for what you called austere. I think that's a great word. Because it was a place where you could have this incredible set of observations and involvement with the cycles of the sky that you couldn't have in the humid jungle. They created a sort of geometric pattern around that that's not quite like what you see in the Mesoamerican sites. It's almost like you had a canvas out there of this desert landscape. And then you have these sculpted forms that you could take roads to. I think of it as not just casually put there by mistake or accretionary or even like the Pueblos today along a nice river or near some springs. It's insane. It doesn't make sense. They could have been by the Chusco Mountains where they got all their resources, their timber and food. It could have been down near Zuni, which has nice fields, or along the Rio Grande. Why there? Even Aztecs, 65 miles north, where they tend to go later, had two rivers. So this is madness.
Well, maybe they left because they're like, screw this.
It's too hard. It's too hard. And we're working too hard.
Yeah.
And there's talk of maybe enslaving, and Rich might tell the Navajo stories of the way they look upon the dark side of Chaco that are pretty explicit.
People enslaved.
Who enslaved whom?
The builders of Chaco enslaved people in the region to build it.
Maybe indentured.
Or indentured, yeah. That's probably a better way to look at it.
Yeah, or whatever. I mean, we have to put our language onto.
Yeah. That's the other problem. I mean, you're dealing with, well, when you're talking about oral traditions, you're dealing with concepts that we don't have in our culture, literally. Right. We don't have it. And trying to turn that concept into something that's even understandable in English is quite often quite difficult, if even possible. And then you're trying to describe a world and understand a world like Chaco that we aren't even a part of, and yet we're trying to say, oh, we know it's this because of this, this, and this. Well, maybe, but we're thinking with our minds, not with their minds.
To what extent have all these sites been excavated, been studied archaeologically? To what extent have they been sort of left alone? Because you're sort of alluding to the idea that not all stories are to be told, not all dirt is to be moved. What's the reality?
I would say that on the whole, in this entire Chaco region, which is about the size of Ohio, somewhere around 150 of these great house complexes, very, very few have been excavated. Certainly fewer than 20.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got the large-scale excavations in the late 1800s, early 1900s in downtown Chaco at Pueblo Bonito, where, you know, the wondrous things I described earlier were uncovered. But most of the great houses in the canyon have not been excavated. Most of the outliers have not been, and they will not be. So there's a lot that will not be known in that way. Nowadays, most is done through on-the-ground mapping and looking at artifacts that have been previously excavated.
What we want to do is make Chaco more real to people. Because these things that we're learning, just talking to each other all the time, just blow our minds. But we don't have much company. To think of all of these 150 buildings, to imagine them all being three-dimensional. So they go up 2-3 stories, and they're 300 miles from Arizona up to southeastern Utah is amazing. And it's only with new technologies, mappings, that we can begin to make that real to people. And so they can enter like Pueblo Bonito and have the experience in an animation of going in there. That's our hope.
A kind of virtual reality?
Yeah. And walk along a road. What was that like?
Yeah, Chaco is, well, it's experiential. I mean, you've got to experience it at the same scale that the people who built it experienced it. And as ruins, they're quite impressive, but there's so much missing that a lot of that really impressive goes away. Where if you can rebuild it, then you can actually sort of experience just how big it is and put it in a scalar context that fits what you're looking at. And in our minds, we tend to, anything large, we tend to make smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you go to Costco or Sam's Club, you buy something, you think it's not very big, you get it home and you realize you can't get it in the door. So we just do that automatically in our own minds. We make things smaller. Where Chaco, we do that, but if you can experience it in a way that relates that scale to you, you realize how big it is. And there are other things with Chaco. I worked with John Stein for many years, and he always used the term architectural vocabularies. And that's something that, you know, Chaco, it speaks to you in architectural language. And that's why was Pueblo Bonito, you know, excavated? Because it's the biggest thing on the landscape. You know, and that architectural vocabulary is still there. You walk up and you go, wow, that's big. And that's the same with all the outliers. They are the biggest thing on the landscape, the biggest, you know, man-made thing on the landscape. So there's this vocabulary that goes on that talks to you, and these vocabularies are repeated over and over through each site. And even though the placement of different elements might be different, that same feeling or essence of knowing where you are and where things are in relation to each other is the same regardless of where you go.
Who owns or manages or controls this land?
Well, the Park Service, with about 12 miles in one direction, about 6 miles in another. It's a great rectangle, basically, around the major buildings. But we're looking at this right now because they also made nice fences around buildings. But these are fences that only go out about 50 feet from the buildings. But now we understand the paradigm of what a building, a great house, is. It is landscape and the building. It is these roads that are going to special places in the landscape. So while the park controls that inner core of great buildings and protects it, we need to make people aware that it's a much bigger interrelated sort of web.
Now, that much bigger interrelated web, is that the part that's threatened by oil and gas drilling?
Especially to the north. Unfortunately, where the North Road goes, you would see a great deal of fracking rigs and older rigs and modern roads that cross the Great North Road. So it's been very despairing for me, anyway, to see that. However, a great deal of the sites are on Navajo land on the reservation, and they seem to be quite well protected. And now where I think the fracking is most threatening is to the actual people living in Counselors and Encino and those chapter house areas to the southeast and east. And they're really going at it right there. So at the moment, it's more erosion, grazing, effects of time on the roads that Rich has studied so carefully. He has records that go back to Lindbergh, and he can see the changes. The soil conservation did 30s, 60s, and aerial imagery he looks at.
Yeah, it's kind of to understand it conceptually, you can think of it, you know, so the road's created at 1000 AD, and that's when they quit using it, so... And maybe every 100 years it loses 10% of its visibility. So after 100 years and 90% of visibility, it's still pretty easy to see. After 500 years, 50% of visibility, it's getting pretty hard. After 900 years, it's down to 90% visibility. That's beginning to get really hard. And once you get to that 90%, every percent from there on, you're getting into that range to where you can no longer see it. And if you can't see it because this region is so vast and so large and the roads sometimes do things that we don't expect them to do, your chance of finding that road is virtually none because they're hard to see in cross-section even. You know, when you excavate a road, they're only trained geomorphologists can really see them. So once they go away, they're gone.
Is there an idea of restoring them?
No.
There's young Rob.
Yeah.
He's going to do his PhD thesis on the roads. And with Rich, they're going to apply this technology of LIDAR and aerial photogrammetry with drones.
Yeah.
I think part of what the invisibility of the roads has led to is a lessening of the Chaco story. The fact that here in New Mexico in the Four Corner States, we have a amazing culture, just like we talk about, you know, in the old world with the Mycenaeans and all these cultures, but very few people know that there's this enormous landscape of monumental buildings, vast roads that are, you know, based around some sort of a compelling ideology. I mean, that's an amazing story, but outside of New Mexico, people aren't hearing it. And I think the more, as Anna talked about, making 3D models and animations and showing people what's out there that otherwise cannot be seen is how that story is going to come to light. And that's how people are going to want to protect this landscape, and that's how people are going to care and see Chaco for what it was.
Are you going to make a Chaco video game?
Actually, we don't have Andrew with us. We have one other collaborator here, not here. He's a young fellow who graduated St. John's with two MAs, very smart, and he loves games. And we have the fundamentals of a game with the Sundagger site, because we made an exact replication in 3D modeling with close-range laser scanning. So every aspect of the site is replicated. It's just beautiful. And it has the tools to be a Chaco astronomer. Play the game. Can you make these slabs come into position that you like that can also make the sun and the moon come together on a spiral?
Excellent. We will let you know, ladies and gentlemen, when this when this happens. Anna Sofair is an author, archaeoastronomer, and founder of the Solstice Project. Rob Weiner is getting his PhD in archaeology at the University of Colorado Boulder. Rich Friedman is a geologist and GIS specialist. And once again, they will be speaking at the James A. Little Theater on Thursday, the 24th of January. At 6:30 in the evening, it's at the School for the Deaf on Cerrillos Road in Santa Fe. It's called Chacoan Astronomy, Cosmography, Roads, and Ritual Power, Insights into the Chaco World Using New Technologies. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was great fun.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.